Hi guys, welcome to our sister podcast, Our Killer Podcast.
Yep, that's the name.
If you're new here and have never heard of our original podcast, it is Our Inner Thoughts, can be found anywhere, I guess.
Pretty much. We're on Breaker,
Spotify,
yeah. Apple Music, literally a bajillion different things. If you ever want to know where we are, you could just go to anchor.fm/ourinnerthoughts and you'll find our website. But as I'm looking at it, we're on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Breaker, Castbox, Overcast, Pocket Cast, and Radio Public. So you guys have absolutely no excuse not to come listen to us. Absolutely. So if it wasn't clear, this is a true crime podcast.
Has it, you know, if you probably
says in the title.
Section, then yeah. So each week we will be discussing two cases, one chose by me, Tay,
and one chose by me, Gia.
And we will be discussing just the whole the details of the case. It could be a really long podcast or really short, just depending on the week. And yep. Gia and I both choose ones that interest us. We could be doing very famous ones, such as Ted Bundy, which will probably come up soon, or lesser known ones that we found.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much just things that tickle our morbidly inclined minds. Yes. But yeah. So, this week's a little bit special because, I mean, one, because it's the first episode, and also because this is the first time we are kind of recording and not being able to, like, be right next to each other.
Yeah, so, we are both at our own homes right now.
Yep, so we are recording via the phone because our wonderful host website, Anchor, they have this option in which you can kind of call each other to make a podcast, and it really, it makes this so much less stressful, honestly.
A lot easier because we kind of live far from each other.
A little bit, but yeah, so hopefully we'll be able to give you guys some live, well, not live, but kind of like in-person episodes real soon. So Tay's experiencing a little bit of allergies.
Yeah, I feel like if we didn't tell them, they might not know the difference. It's pretty good. I didn't expect it to be this well, but yeah, guys, I'm having allergy problems, but that includes congestion, runny nose, and a small minor cough. No fever, but it is COVID season, and COVID is bigger and spreading more than it ever has. So just y'all's friendly reminder to be safe, keep yourself safe, sanitize, wash your hands, take proper precautions, social distancing, and wearing masks to keep you and your family and all of your friends safe. Like, not just y'all. Keep everybody that you know safe, everybody that you come in contact with, so that everybody can enjoy the holiday season.
Yeah. So, just out of an abundance of caution, we are doing this over the phone.
Yes. We
still wanted to give you guys the podcast that we promised you, so here we are.
You know, actually, I've heard that, like, every single person I know is having some kind of allergy problem.
The allergies are terrible this year, honestly.
It's the worst time for it to be this bad.
I went to the doctor, like, a few weeks ago, and the doctor, she looks at me and she's like, "So, hey, Phil," and I was like, "I'm all right, just some allergies, you know, the usual," and she does her checkup, and she's like, "You have really inflamed lymph nodes and, like, very congested, like, nasal passages, and, like, you've got some serious drip going on. These are just, like, allergies. You got, like, severe allergies, kiddo," and I'm like, "Yeah, oh, that's fun," because I've lived here for several years and no doctor has been like, "Oh yeah, you have severe allergies."
Man, I cannot relate. I've had to go to specialists so many times. Like, it's, I can't even get into that right now, but I think we should go ahead and start.
Yep. So you can go first or I can go first.
I'll go first this time, and then we'll switch it around. Okay. So that we're always going first the same weeks on both.
Gotcha.
So this week I will be discussing the, as you probably read in the title or the description, the disappearance of Monique Daniels.
Honestly, let's be honest, no one reads the description before they listen to a podcast.
Yeah, that's why the title is so important. But, so it'll probably be in the title. But anyways, I wanted this to be the first one that I covered, because I feel like we've all, I mean, if y'all are true crime junkies like we are, we've all heard that one case that just doesn't leave your mind.
You know? It resonates with you a little bit.
Yes. This one is that case. I remember so many details about it. I literally was talking to my friend about it the other day. Like, it really, I mean, guys, it gives me the chills. There's certain things I will never do again. Like, I never leave my shower curtain closed anymore. It's just, it's bad. So, with that amazing introduction, let's get into it.
Wait, I have a question, though.
What?
You never leave your shower curtain closed. The water gets everywhere, doesn't it?
No, I mean, like, when I'm not in the shower.
Oh.
It's open.
My big brain.
So, Monique Daniels was born in 1977 in Moore, Oklahoma. She disappeared on the 2nd of June in 1992. When she disappeared, she was 15 years old. Her mother's name was Candace. Her biological dad was in and out of prison. He was mentally and physically abusive, and he was not really present in Monique's life for a lot of her childhood. Well, the mom remarried to a man named Charles Daniels, but we're going to call him Chuck, because that's what he was called.
Hey, Chuck.
No, we don't like Chuck.
No, not to give never mind. Spoilers, bye, Chuck.
But we don't like Chuck.
Goodbye, Chuck.
Goodbye, Chuck. So they had 6 kids total, like, in the family. I don't have the exact number that were Chucks, but I think maybe 2 or 3 of them were Chucks, and 3 of them were four or three of them were from the previous husband. So, gotcha. To give kind of an insight of what the household was like that Monique lived in, both of her parents were from the military, so it was a very strict household.
Oh, yeah.
It was always neat and tidy. It was always in order, you know. And there was constant fighting in the home. They had...
Sounds like they both had a superiority complex.
Oh, I did write it here. Sorry. Chuck and Candace had 2 kids.
Oh, gotcha.
And so Candace had 4 before.
Still a lot of kids, though.
Oh, yeah. That's a lot of kids. But she had 2 with Chuck and 4 with her previous abusive husband, so.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Monique's life wasn't that much better living under this roof. It was just a lot of fighting, a lot of, you know, disputes, just, you know. It was rough.
Just so, anger.
Monique was described as someone who always put others ahead of herself. She was well-liked, she had a lot of friends, she did very well in school, and she had dreams to be a doctor. She was also very kind to others. So, Monique had a sister, Angelique, and they were close. In fact, when Monique disappeared, Angelique and Monique's aunt, Leslie, which is the aunt's name. So that's so aggressive. Leslie. They actually fronted the whole investigation. Like, her sister and her aunt fronted the whole thing.
Dang.
So, anyways, back to when Monique was still alive. It's 1992. And she fell pregnant. Now, she was 16 years old. She was beautiful. Like, I'm going to... insert on our Instagram page a photo of her. If you want to go see our Instagram, go to the description. It is...
Wait, how do you fall pregnant? Do you just, like, trip upstairs and then BAM! Pregnant.
No, it's just a saying for, like, became pregnant. So if y'all want to go follow...
I know, I'm just messing with you.
If y'all want to go follow our Instagram, it's Our Killer Podcast. Just Our Killer Podcast. You can see a picture of what Monique looked like. Well... In 1992, she fell pregnant, and Chuck forced Monique to have an abortion. And Monique was extremely upset about this. I mean, as she should be. That's hard. You know, that's one of those things. It's a personal choice. And she didn't want to lose her baby.
It's like, even if you want to do that, it's still hard.
Yeah. So Monique was very upset and went to stay with a friend. Her parents... So, okay. Here's the thing. When she was upset, she went to stay with her friend. So she kind of like ran away from home for like a few days. And when this happened the first time, her parents were very like responsive and persistent. This is very important. They immediately reported Monique missing.
Mm-hmm.
So Monique finally went home and things were kind of tense after that point. You know, parents were upset that she got pregnant in the first place. Upset that she ran away from home, like, you know?
Yeah, just a bunch of things at once.
Yeah. So 3 weeks before Monique turned 16, her mom, Angelique, which is her sister, and her brother Brian went on a tour with a church choir.
That's not good.
So when they got back...
I'm just sensing it right now.
Yeah. So when they got back, the house was a mess. Beer bottles and cigarettes were, like, lying around. On the bathroom counter was, like, an empty pregnancy test box.
What?
Yeah. Like, because Angelique noticed that. And when they walked in, they saw Chuck, and he said, like, okay, the way that this was described in all the interviews with the family is when they walked into the house, you know, Candace looked at Chuck, and he just said, she's gone again.
Oh, no.
And Candace was just kind of like, oh.
Well, that's that. She's gone. All right.
Oh, okay. They didn't even, like, seem to care. As well as Chuck didn't seem to care either. And they did not try to look for her.
Chuck sounds a little bit like a drunk.
He's actually not.
Really?
Yeah. That's why when they came home and there was, like, all this stuff, like, that's not normal. Because their house is usually kept very clean.
Yeah.
So, this is awful. They started removing... So, okay. They have not reported Monique missing. They have not done anything to look for her. Like, that's where we are right now, right?
Yeah.
Well, they started removing Monique from their lives up to this point. They forbid the children from talking about her. Yes. They forbid the children from talking about her in the house.
They said, oh, your sibling's missing, so the other five ones can't talk.
Yeah. They her name was not allowed to be brought up.
That's
insane. They took down any photos of her. They even went as far as to redo their family portraits without her in it.
That's such an odd response to someone going missing.
They acted like she did not exist.
That's so weird. It's like your kid goes missing and instead of... Well, I guess your kid runs away and was their thinking. And their first response is to immediately ignore her as if she didn't exist in their lives?
Yeah.
That's
so
insane.
So, of course, all this happening, Angelique, her sister, was very concerned. So, Leslie, the aunt, was also very concerned and would constantly call for updates, offered to help search for her and get resources. And Candace said no, but they did not want to look. So, 6 months... After her disappearance, Leslie asked Candace for Monique's missing persons report. Because, you know, Candace said, yeah, we filed it.
They didn't file it.
Candace never filed one. Leslie was getting suspicious. Leslie decided to take over and called the police. After this, Candace claims to have gotten a call from Monique. So, okay. Sorry, guys, having a hard time talking because my throat's awful. So.
It's okay.
Basically, Leslie goes to the police, and right after this, Candace claims she got a phone call from Monique.
That's really suspicious.
And tells the whole family not to worry that she heard from her. A week later, she got a letter from Monique. The letter was from Dallas, Texas, and stated Monique saying she was married with a child and her husband has to travel for work and that she was living in Alaska. Leslie was suspicious due to all the timing of this letter.
That doesn't make any sense. Like, I disappeared 6 months ago. I now have a kid. I never aborted the original one, just so you know.
If y'all remember, when they walked in the house, there was an empty pregnancy test on the counter.
Well, yeah, but that was only 6 months ago.
But we don't know how... It was a while ago when she had the abortion.
Oh.
Theoretically, she had time to get pregnant again.
I suppose.
Yeah.
Continue. Sorry. I just didn't like that discrepancy. It didn't make sense in my brain.
Yeah, it's kind of all crazy. But
as well as the fact that she said she's living in Alaska, but the letter came from Dallas.
Well, her husband travels for work, evidently.
Oh, got it.
So, with all this, Leslie, the aunt, was suspicious due to the timing of the letter and the phone call. Leslie wanted to take the letters into the police to be authenticated. So... of course, you know, Monique's family agreed to this. And a day before she was supposed to take them in, Candace's house was broken into. The furniture was tipped over, CDs were missing, a few little, like, boom boxes, and the letters.
That's suspicious. Who breaks into a house to steal a boom box?
Like, seriously, it was worthless items. They had jewelry and diamond. Like, no.
One breaks into a house to steal a boombox.
And letters. Why would they have an interest in that? So, a little bit after this, Angelique, who is Monique's sister, she confessed to writing the letters and making the phone call.
Oh.
Well, it's interesting. She claimed that Chuck forced her to. Because Candace was, suicidal. Angelique never came forward before because Chuck threatened her. Angelique thought they sent her to the military camp. 1 year later, Angelique was tired of everything and ran away to Michigan to live with her Aunt Leslie and told her everything about the letters, about the phone call. Like, in Angelique's mind, she was kind of like, oh, they sent her to a military camp.
And then when they were like, she realized, like, oh, they just don't know where she is.
Yeah. So after talking with her Aunt Leslie, with her aunt, Leslie and Angelique believed Chuck and Candace were guilty of Monique's disappearance in some way.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as Angelique ran away, her parents filed a missing report, persons report, immediately.
On Angelique?
Yes.
Ugh, that's so hypocritical.
This fueled Angelique's investigation. 22 months after Monique disappeared, when Angelique ran away, Chuck and Candace finally filed a missing persons report on Monique.
22 months?
Yes.
That's almost 2 years.
Yeah.
The most vital information is literally within a day of someone's kidnapping. Oh my gosh.
Well, disappearance, but yes. The police started the investigation. When trying to talk to Chuck and Candace, they were completely uncooperative and refused to take a lie detector test. In the investigation, questioning neighbors, one man saw Monique loading clothes into a blue Chevy truck with a white male. This led nowhere and was the only information they got from neighbors. Angelique admits to her Aunt Leslie that her parents are both physically and mentally abusive. She filed childhood abuse charges due to the parents trying to force Angelique to come home so that when Chuck and Candace were charged, they pledged no contest. So basically, she wanted to live with her aunt because they were mentally and physically abusive. And then because they were like, we want you to come home, she was like, I'm gonna charge you with these things. They were like, oh, you can just stay.
That was a little more trouble than we were asking for. Never mind.
At this time, Leslie and Angelique started going public on TV appearances, claiming they believe Chuck and Candace are responsible.
Mm-hmm.
They went on the current affair interview and accused Chuck and Candace. Right after this interview, Chuck and Candace mourned their Chuck and Candace moved their family to Germany due to Chuck's military thing.
Military thing.
So we're gonna fast forward a bit. Angelique gets a call from her brother Andrew. So that's Monique's brother, Andrew. And he said, Ange, I was there and she wasn't breathing. That's
dude.
All he said.
Where were you?
Honestly. Hold on, I'm getting like creeped out, so I'm gonna move somewhere else in my room.
Oh no.
No, this is like office case. Can you still hear me?
Yes, I can hear you just fine.
Yeah. So then Andrew then starts telling his story, and this is Andrew's story. The day they left for choir camp, Monique and Chuck were fighting. So if y'all remember, let me check. Who was it that went on? Oh, Brian, Angelique, and the mom went on a choir trip, while the two brothers, Andrew and I forgot who else, and Monique and Chuck were home.
Mm-hmm.
The day they left for the choir camp, Monique and Chuck were fighting. Chuck then gathered all the boys. Sorry, there were three boys.
Just keep messing up there, buddy.
I know, right? For a spontaneous fishing trip, he told the boys to go say goodbye to Monique. They were not allowed to enter her room. They had to say goodbye from the door. Andrew said he could see her legs. She was sitting, propped up against her head, her bed, with her legs crossed, and she did not respond and was still.
That's a little suspicious.
Oh, it gets worse.
Oh, no.
They left with no fishing rods. They went on a highway, took a random exit, went to McDonald's, and went home. When they got home, Chuck told them to stay in the car for over an hour and told them they couldn't get out. After an hour went by, Chuck let them out. Andrew went to the bathroom. And he had an eerie feeling someone was in the bathtub.
Oh boy.
But didn't get the opportunity to check.
Oh, geez.
Chuck pulled him out of the bathroom, locked the boys in the bedroom for 2 days.
And said
he was going to look for Monique. After the 2 days, Andrew and Chuck, And Chuck took Andrew in the truck. Sorry, there's a lot of Chuck trucks, whatever. And Andrew just remembers seeing, like, an oil barrel in the back.
That's never good, an oil drum.
Angelique and Andrew went to the police, and the police dug up the whole backyard of their childhood home. When Chuck and Candace were questioned again, they told the police that Angelique was a terrible kid and not to trust her.
Oh, yeah, that's credible.
Of being an alcoholic and a drug addict.
Oh, boy.
Both of which claims were denied by Angelique, and she did have some mental health problems, but never abused substances. When asked what he thinks happened to Monique, like Chuck, he responds with, It's in God's, I don't know. So he'll be like, it's in God's hands, I don't know.
Interesting. That's...
But...
That sounds like someone's blaming someone else.
Yeah. Daniel, who is the other brother's story, was different. He claimed he was the last to speak to Monique before the fishing trip, she was lying on the bed and hugged him and said, "I'm so sorry, I'm sick, I'm so sorry, I can't come."
That's odd. I wonder why their stories differ.
Well, yeah. And that's it.
Dang.
Her case is still not solved to this day.
So they've never found the body, and they still don't know.
Found the body.
Who did it?
They don't have any actual evidence against Chuck and Candace.
I'm gonna be honest, I feel like Chuck did it.
Oh, 100%. There's no doubt about it.
Simply because of all of everything that you just read, it's just Chuck seems like the most likely, but I'm kind of curious as to why the boys' stories differ.
Well, they differ from before they left for the fishing trip, so it doesn't really bother me that much.
Yeah, but it kind of bothers me a little bit, which kind of makes me feel like Andrew. It was Andrew, right?
Yeah.
Andrew has a little bit of guilt in some instance, but I'm obviously not a detective, so.
Yeah, so that's the story, Monique. It's just so creepy to me to think when Andrew was in that bathroom, he just had a feeling that there was somebody in the tub. Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah, it totally could have been Monique's body.
Uh-huh.
It probably was, honestly, the way that his father reacted.
Yeah, so that is the end of the disappearance of Monique Daniels. We're going to pause for a quick sec to take a break and for an ad. So, and yep. Then we'll listen to the disappearance that Gia has chose this week.
Yes, we shall. Mine's a little spooky, boys.
Yikes. Okay. Well, we'll be back.
Bye. Hello.
We are back. Had a bit of a scare thinking that last one didn't save, but it did. Just 27 minutes of content.
Yeah. That would have been pretty scary because we would have had to do the whole thing over again.
Seriously.
Yeah. But it's okay now. And now you guys get to hear the wonderful, terrifying, not really that scary story of the mysterious death of Elisa Lam and the elevator game. So, to start with, Elisa Lam arrived in LA on January 26th, 2013. She is originally from Vancouver. Her trip to LA was a supposed vacation from the University of British Columbia, which is in Vancouver, and for those of you who aren't privy to world maps, Vancouver is in Canada.
And Canada is in North America.
Yep, that is true. Canada is in North America.
Canada is above the United States.
Yes, these are all correct.
The United States is above Mexico.
Yes, this is also correct. Anyway. So this trip was a solo expedition, from her like place of origin in Canada. And so to kind of like ease her parents' minds, Elisa would contact them every day of the trip. So Elisa Lam checked into the infamous Cecil Hotel in LA, which is down by Skid Row, which is the host of many suicides, death, murders, and was the home of the Cecil Hotel in downtown LA.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. And so basically, this hotel kind of hosts a bunch of suicide, deaths, murders, and even housed two murderers, including the Night Stalker. That we're aware of anyways. Originally, Elisa Lam shared a room with others, but after she was reported that she had odd behavior after 2 days, they moved out of the room. So basically, Elisa was kind of being a little weird. And so because of this consistent messaging that Alyssa had promised her parents, Alyssa Lam's parents were concerned when their daughter didn't contact them on January 31st, 5 days after Alyssa had arrived at the Cecil Hotel. So something to note here is that Alyssa Lam was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and depression. Her family kept her mental illness a secret, and she didn't have a history of suicide ideation or attempts, other than a slight concerning event in which she went missing for a short period of time. So, it is really odd. So,
do they know why?
What do you mean? Do they know why she disappeared that one time?
Yeah.
They don't.
She just was like, I'm not telling you.
They also don't know where she went. Mm-hmm. So the Lam family reported their concern to the Los Angeles Police Department after Alyssa Lam was supposed to check out on the 31st and neglected to do so. So the 31st is also the day that she didn't contact her family. So a woman named Katie Orphan, who was the manager of a nearby bookstore, was the last person to see Alyssa Lam alive on the 31st of January. So, due to the circumstances, the police could only search a certain amount without violating the hotel's rights. Simply because it was a missing persons case, they weren't allowed to kind of, like, deep comb the hotel.
Yeah.
So, basically, they could only search a certain amount without violating the hotel's rights, which included them searching the room, her room, and they had dogs go through all of the public spaces in the hotel, as well as the roof, but were unable to find Alyssa. Kind of was just
hey,
he just
you
was
just
gone
cut out
suddenly.
Like a little bit. You might want to repeat that in case it didn't get in the audio. Gia?
Uh-oh.
I can hear you. Are you good?
Hold on. I think I lost you for a split second there.
I lost you for a second, too.
All right, we're back. It's okay. All righty. I'm going to continue my story because that was kind of briefly scary. So another thing to note is that a week after Lam disappeared, the police were basically getting nowhere because they had no leads, no clues, no evidence, nothing. And so they began to pass out flyers and use the internet and social media to kind of gain traction about the case and draw attention to it. But here's where things get interesting. So after Alyssa Lam had been missing for about 2 weeks, the LAPD released a video that showcased Alyssa kind of darting in and out of the elevator again and again in a consistently erratic behavior. So she would rub her arms and consistently, like, leer around the entrance to the elevator and go in and out of it really fast, as if she was kind of either looking for something or hiding from someone.
Yeah.
So many theories emerge from this video and her behavior, because basically they thought that she was either suffering from a psychotic episode or that the video was edited or tampered with. And this essentially made people kind of assume that her disappearance or possible death was because of murder. Obviously, we know she's dead now, but at that time, people didn't know.
That's rough.
Mm-hmm. So basically, guests were complaining about the water pressure being low, like the guests of the hotel, as well as the water having an odd taste with an odd black color or tint to it.
Lead.
So, the video was released February 15th, and Lam's body was discovered on February 19th. So, Lam's body was found in one of the four large water tanks, bringing water to rooms, the kitchens, and to a coffee shop. Yes. So basically, they were drinking Alyssa Lam.
Some of her, at least.
Some of her, at least. So According to the coroner's report from February 21st that was posted later in June of that year, her body was found naked, but there were no signs of physical trauma, sexual assault, or suicide. There was a sand-like particle on her clothing, and her clothing was in the tank with her, but not on her.
Interesting.
The toxicology report showed that other than prescribed drugs for her mental disorders, she had less than 0.02 g% of alcohol in her system, and Sinitol and ibuprofen, with no other recreational drugs. So she wasn't drugged. She didn't really have that much alcohol in her system. So she only was having her medicines. So
yeah. So it wasn't like a poisoning or anything.
Mm-hmm. So the mysterious thing about this case is how she got into the water tank to begin with. So basically, according to staff, the doors and stairs that accessed the roof were always locked and couldn't be opened without a passcode or key. And if the door to either of those things were attempted to be, like, forced open, an alarm would go off. So basically, if Elisa tried to go up into the roof, they would know about it. They would have known she was there. But basically, there are some other things where saying that the fire escape was accessible to the average person, which is what they think, how they think she got up there, but they don't know. Yeah. So the other thing, though, is that the tanks were 4 by 8 foot cylinders. So basically 4 feet wide and 8 feet tall. And so this woman was like 5 foot something. There is no way she could have climbed up there by herself, especially since they were propped up by like concrete blocks, and there were no ways to climb up into the tanks.
Yeah.
So the lids were extremely heavy and were hard, but not impossible to kind of move in from out, like up from the inside if need be.
Yeah.
And at the time of the kind of the supposed disappearance, or at the time of discovery, two of the lids to the things were open, but not the one that Elisa Lam was in. Yes. So I'm going to give you guys a little bit of an explanation to what the elevator game is before I get into what my theory is.
So this is still unsolved?
Yes. They have absolutely no clue what happened to her. Like, they don't know how she got in there. They don't know what happened. They know that she died, and they know that she died by drowning, but they don't know how she got up there or how she got into the tank. Mm-hmm. So the elevator game is a quote game that originated in Korea that is a ritual to travel to another world. Players will enter the elevators and press floor buttons in a specific order before landing on the 5th floor, where the portal to the other world was. In this game, there is a woman who comes into the elevator, and you are told that if you look at her, bad things will happen. And you are warned explicitly not to get off on any of the floors unless it's specifically told you to in the directions of the game. There are no explanations as to why. So, my theory is kind of a blend of two common theories. So, if you believe that the elevator game is real and have a mental disorder, you will most likely play to maybe escape your reality. So, what I'm thinking is that someone convinced Elisa Lam to play the elevator game during a psychotic break. I believe that that someone murdered Elisa Lam by throwing or convincing her to go into the water tank as a part of the game.
Huh.
Or, because I feel there are a lot of kind of people who think that the game was the reason she died. Like, she looked at the woman or something like that. And that's kind of silly to me, and I feel like we look to kind of supernatural reasonings as to why things happen so that we don't have to kind of face the truth of what's happening. So, but yeah, so that is the mysterious death of Elisa Lam.
Interesting.
So
that
yeah,
one's really odd.
Yeah, it's really odd. And that's just one of the more kind of famous things that happened at the Cecil Hotel. Some other kind of infamous things other than what I've mentioned is obviously the murderers that stayed there, and then also the Black Dahlia murder happened around the Cecil Hotel.
I knew I recognized that name.
And so is know what the Black Dahlia murder, that's Elizabeth Short. And if you don't know the Black Dahlia murder, you should go look it up. It's absolutely insane. Oh, we should cover insane. That 1 week. It's
if y'all awful. Want to hear us cover the story of the Black Dahlia, leave us, DM us on Instagram, email us, and
you can literally this information. I will cover it. I promise. It's interesting. But yeah, so it's just insane. They just don't know what happened to her, and they don't know how she got up there. Like, a bunch of people kind of just chalk it up to she had a psychotic break and she went into the water tower because she thought it was the pool, or
she can't get up there.
But she can't get up there. It's an 8-foot tall cylinder of steel or metal with no way to climb up there by yourself.
Emphasis on cylinder.
Emphasis on cylinder. So there's nothing for you to kind of like hook onto at all. So I'll probably be putting up some pictures of Elisa Lam and also these cylinders of the water tower on the Instagram, or at least giving them to Tay to show you guys, because it's just
we'll post some photos about each podcast or each podcast, guys.
I'm each done. Episode
about each episode and what mysteries and true crime cases, not mysteries because we're not always gonna do mysteries, but cases that we'll be covering. So if y'all want to go to our Instagram, you can get photos of things about each episode.
Yeah, but it's like, if you look at these things, you're like, there's no way she could have scaled that. And so it's so heartbreaking to me, because this woman's parents immediately knew something was wrong.
Yeah.
Like, the day she didn't reply, the day she was supposed to check out, they called the police from a country away. Like, it doesn't make any sense when you think about it.
That's really odd.
Like, if you put everything together, immediately what people go to is that Elisa Lam had a psychotic break and drowned herself by accident, because you'll put together her erratic behavior in the elevator, and then her erratic behavior earlier causing her roommate to move, and you put it together as she stopped taking her meds. But then with the toxicology report, she was taking her meds.
To me, and it sounds like she was murdered.
Exactly. And a lot of people really feel like she was murdered, or that there was more evidence to the video, but that the video was tampered with. Because a lot of, you can look this up. If you look up Elisa Lam elevator footage, that's ELISALAM elevator footage, you can watch her, and it's really erratic behavior. She's just going in and out, darting, pressing random buttons, looking around as if she's hiding from someone, and it's odd. It's just really odd, and it's not gone anywhere since the beginning. And a lot of people also think that maybe she had more drugs in her system, but because she was rotting in the water tower for 2.5-3 weeks, that a lot of what was could have been tested was already dispersed. But yeah, so that's the mysterious death of Elisa Lam and the elevator game. So yeah.
Well, that concludes our episode of our killer podcast for this week. If y'all have any requests for cases for us to do in the following episodes, you can DM us on Instagram or email us. Links will be in the description.
And honestly, we would love if you guys like sent us your stories, if you have any, if you have any close calls or interactions or anything that kind of weirded you out, or any cool stories about people that you think that we should do or things that interest you. We'd love to hear those.
Yeah. We will be posting new episodes every week, every Saturday morning at what time are we saying?
7 a.m., my girl.
7 a.m. Central, I think we are. Tune in every Saturday morning or whenever you feel like it for more cases.
I'm not up at 7 a.m.
And go check out our sister podcast, Our Inner Thoughts, with Gia and Tay.
That is us.
Thank y'all for listening.
Yep, thank you. We really appreciate the support. And we'd love it if you went and listened to both of our podcasts, because we really enjoy doing this and it's really fun to kind of like talk to you guys. So, yeah.
Okay, I'm going to end it because I don't know how to do outros. So,
have a great week. Bye.
Oh, I remember what I was going to say.
Or not.
Like half of them already logged off.
Logged off.
Have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful Thanksgiving and stay safe.
Bye.